Coming up on Triangulation, I, Jason Howell, sit down with Bruce Schneier, security expert and author of the new book, Click Here to Kill Everybody. See, we got your attention. Triangulation is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 374, recorded Friday, November 30th, 2018. Bruce Schneier, Click Here to Kill Everybody. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And by CuriosityStream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 2,000 documentaries and nonfiction titles from some of the world's best filmmakers, including exclusive originals. Visit CuriosityStream.com/twit and use code TWIT to get 1 month free. Hello and welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we sit down with some of the people who make the biggest news, who make the biggest splashes on the internet and, you know, beyond. Today's guest is no different. He actually just wrote a book that has a title that I got to say, I love the title on this book. Click Here to Kill Everybody. You know that when you see this on the bookshelf, you're going to go, what the heck did I just read? And it's a fantastic book. Bruce Schneier, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, but I'm standing, not sitting. I hope that's okay.
That's okay. I'm sitting. We can kind of split the difference. Everybody knows you. You're a security expert online. You're board member of the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Also lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, author of 13 books on security. And then, of course, Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. To say you are a busy man is, I feel like, a big understatement. You keep yourself very busy in the world of security.
I do. I do a lot. Luckily, I get a lot done on airplanes, so good. That helps.
You maximize your time. So I actually had both Megan Maroney and I had the pleasure of chatting with you, I think it was like a month and a half ago on Tech News Weekly, another show on the Twit Network. And we got to kind of take a cursory kind of top level look at the topics that your book cover in greater detail. So I'm really excited to kind of sit down or stand and talk to you about this stuff in greater detail, because right now, man, we are at such an inflection point of, you know, the Internet of Things and technology just be commanding so much of our lives. And I guess we're kind of, I don't know, would you say that we're biting off more than we could chew at this stage of the game?
We've probably been biting off more than we can chew for the past, 50 years? I mean, right? I mean, it's all we can do to hold on and hope for the best. It's just, that's just getting a little more dangerous. You know, as technologies get more critical, sort of not steering and hoping for the best ceases to be a good strategy. We're seeing that in a lot of places. So I think this is a continuation of a lot of trends, and that's what I'm trying to talk about in the book.
What is it about this moment in time that makes it so possible for someone to click somewhere and actually potentially kill someone? Because I think your title raises eyebrows, and it's an interesting title for a book. It's easy to read that and be like, haha, that's really funny. What is the book about? But I mean, that's really like kind of the grand thesis, is that the internet and where we are at right now with security has real world implications that could potentially kill someone.
Well, that's the difference, right? The computers are the same, the operating system is the same, the security, all the stuff is the same. What's different is computers now affect the world in a direct physical manner.
Right.
That it's not just our laptops and our phones, it's our thermostats and our cars and our power plants and our embedded heart monitors and our toys and our everything, our appliances. And those are now computers. So when you add automation, autonomy, and physical agency, suddenly you have computers that can harm life and property. And that's the difference. The title is meant to be kind of a joke, but also not. You know, just as we can now, you know, click here to infect all Windows machines or all Firefox browsers or whatever it is, soon we'll be able to do that with physical objects that can harm. And that's really what I'm talking about. And that's the inflection point. It's not about security. It's about what computers are doing.
Right. Do you ever place blame on science fiction for kind of planting the seeds of where technology is leading right now? I know I personally feel conflicted on this issue. I remember when I was young and I thought of all the ways that the future was going to be so cool, that our technology was going to do all these things for us and it was going to know us so well and whatever. And we're kind of, to a large degree, realizing this now. We're living this now. And we're starting to also see the unintended consequences of that on the other side. So much of that comes from science fiction. Do you ever blame science fiction for the mess we're in?
You can't blame science fiction. I mean, science fiction is actually pretty terrible at predicting the future. When you read Heinlein, you read the science fiction of the 70s and the 80s, some of the stuff I read as an adolescent and a young adult, and they get everything wrong. And that's because science fiction projects today's technology and today's social issues into the future. It's not very good at predicting technology. It's terrible at predicting social changes due to technology. I mean, like, everyone predicts that you can buy things over computer networks. No one imagined eBay.
Right.
Everyone predicted you'll communicate with friends and colleagues over networks. No one predicted Facebook. You can go on and on. I mean, you just read the futurologists a century ago predicted cars would make you go faster, but they couldn't predict the modern suburb. So it's not science fiction. I mean, what's going on is technology is creating opportunities. Companies, individuals are rushing to fulfill those opportunities. And there's not a lot of discussion about the social implications. And, you know, you could argue that was okay back when the technologies couldn't cause catastrophic harm. You know, now they can, and maybe that's not a great idea. So if anything, that's the inflection point that we're in, that technologies are so harmful. But, you know, you read science fiction to learn about the present, not about the future. And I think a lot of people get confused about that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You also make the point near the end of the book, kind of along the lines of what you're saying there about Blade Runner. And how it's this amazing future where there are androids that are not discernible, you know, from human beings. Yet they're using payphones, you know, with a quarter in order
with a coin, right? They're using coin operated payphones, and you just see that again and again. You know, just watch Star Trek.
Yeah,
right. I mean, there's so many amazing things, but the computers are kind of right out of the 60s.
Yeah, it's almost like reality is more science fiction than science fiction. Talk a little bit about Internet Plus, because this is a term that you coin very much so at the beginning, which is kind of a combination of the internet plus things plus us, and so you kind of shorten that down to Internet Plus, and how that's much bigger than just the Internet of Things that we're used to.
This is interesting. I was surprised that I had to coin a term, because I'm writing about sort of everything, the internet plus the devices connected to it, phones, computers, and the IoT devices, plus the large things connected to it, right? The power plants, the industrial control systems, plus the large data stores, plus the cloud. And you'd think there'd be a term that encompassed it all, but there isn't. And I don't want to invent a term, and I'm not a term inventing kind of person. I'm writing about security. But there wasn't any shorthand for me to say this plus this plus this plus this, and I just got tired of writing that all the time, and I wrote Internet Plus. Now, my hope is that somebody will come up with a better term. But if I call it like the Onosphere or the Nunosphere or the whatever, I'm just going to sound like an idiot. So I kind of took the most benign term I could to get the point across, that when you're looking at tech and its implications to society, whether it's security or anything else, you have to look at it as a whole. You can't look at a piece. You can't look at the IoT. You can't look at just the social networking platforms. You can't look at just the surveillance devices or the sensors, or you can't look at the internet. You got to look at the whole thing. And I think that's really important. And the fact that there wasn't a term is probably telling, mm-hmm. is probably a hole in our conceptualization of what's going on.
Especially as we kind of enter into this age or continue to live in this age where the stakes are so high, combining all of these things, there's going to need to be some easier way to refer to this all, because as your book illustrates, this is going to be to continue becoming a much larger issue over time than it already is, which is not to minimize where we're at right now, because we got right. a lot of problems.
And it'll become much larger. We're going to yeah. connect more and more things to it. I mean, you look at the number of devices that they predict will be attached to the internet, and it's like 10 or 100 per person. And that's just the consumer devices.
Yeah.
You start looking at, you know, the sensors in cities, the industrial systems, the mass of things from power plants, weapon systems. You know, it's all going to be on one internet. You know, there might be segmentation, but in the end, it's basically one network because it all talks to each other sooner or later. Right? The DoD learned that. They try to have their separate SIPRNet, but, you know, it takes a day for viruses to jump from one to the other. It's because someone comes home with their laptop, plugs into the internet, and now everything moves across. So you have to look at it as a whole thing.
Absolutely. So we're gonna dive a little bit into kind of the current state of computer security, kind of the trends around that. You spend the first half of the book, almost third of the book, because the last third of the book is extensive notes. I have to give you so much credit for the amount of notes you put in this book. But anyways, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk kind of about where we're at right now before we get into some of your suggestions and some of your insight into where we could be. But first, let's thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. So let's talk a little bit about interest rates and buying a home right now, because you know that interest rates, they're kind of jumping all over the place. The Fed is raising them ever so slowly. And so they're rising, and that can create a little bit of uncertainty. You might not know when is the right time to jump. Maybe you want to buy a home. You're a little nervous to do it right now. That's why we're talking about Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, because they can help kind of relieve some of that anxiety that you might be feeling. They're doing something about that. They're calling it the power buying process. It's going to make your life just a little bit easier throughout. So here's how it works. First step, you answer a few simple questions. They're going to actually check your credit, and you'll get a pre-qualified approval out of that process. Step two, Quicken Loans will verify your income, your assets, and your credit. Doesn't take very long, just 24 hours or less. And that's going to end up giving you a verified approval, which actually gives you the strength of a cash buyer. So you can jump, you can move when you need to. When you find that home, you can just hop right on it. Step three, once you're all verified, you actually qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval, which basically means that they're going to lock up your rate at that point for up to 90 days while you shop. So 90 days, that rate, whatever it happened to be at that point, in place and locked. And here's the best part. If the rates happen to change, if they happen to go up, let's say the Fed decides to raise the rate, your rate's going to stay the same. So it's going to stay at that lower amount within those 90 days. But if rates go down, your rate will also drop with that drop. So either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking that you would expect from America's largest mortgage lender. So check it out and see what you think. Get started by going to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. All right, so let's talk about where we're at right now. Obviously, things are really complicated from a technical perspective. Why is the internet so insecure on so many levels right now? And I realize that's a really broad question to ask because you go into so much detail in your book. What would you say to start us off?
Well, so let's just talk about a few things. So the first is that most software is poorly written and insecure. Right? We don't want to pay for quality software, with the possible exception of things like the space shuttle. The market doesn't reward well-written software. And poorly written software is full of bugs. Some of them are vulnerabilities. So the software we use is filled with security vulnerabilities. That's simply economics. And for that to change, we're going to have to agree to pay much more for software than we do today. I'm not convinced the market will bear that. Second reason is that we never designed the internet with security in mind. Now, that seems absolutely crazy when I say it today, but if you go back to the late 70s and early 80s, there were two things true about the internet. One, it wasn't used for anything important ever. And two, you had to be a member of an accredited research institution to get access to it in the first place. So for those two reasons, the designers of the internet deliberately decided to ignore security. I mean, it was a design choice. And the idea was that if a process needed security, it could do it at the endpoints. And we're still living with the effects of that decision in packet security, domain name security, routing, email, kind of everything, right? We never built security in from the beginning. Third reason is that complex systems are insecure. Right? Complexity is the worst enemy of security, and it is very hard to secure a complex system. Internet's the most complex machine mankind has ever built. And your phone is the most complex machine sort of anywhere near you by a lot. And that makes it very hard. And then I guess I'll add that the market kind of doesn't reward security. So right now we are in the middle of a massive data breach from Marriott Hotels. Half a billion records were exposed. I am a Starwood customer. I'm probably in that list. And Marriott will probably face no penalty for that. Or if they have a penalty, it'll be minor. And this is not unusual. A year and a half ago, Equifax, massive data breach, affected you, affected me. I testified before Congress over that. There were angry representatives on both sides of the aisle. Something must be done. Fast forward to today, nothing was done. Right? The moral of that was skimp on security, underspend, hope for the best. If the worst happens, weather the bad press, you'll be fine. That's a lesson Facebook is learning today, and that's a lesson Marriott will learn. So right now, we don't get security because that's not what the market is rewarding. There are probably other reasons, but those are probably enough to start.
And I mean, a lot of these companies that you're mentioning right now, those are the big companies too. Like, I have a question around, you know, the market not rewarding good quality software or security. What about hardware? Because like when I look at, you know, when I think of IoT and I think of insecurity, like it's probably all pretty insecure. But I know on Black Friday, I saw a ton of dirt cheap, smart, you know, Wi-Fi smart plugs from companies I've never heard of being offered. And I guarantee you the majority of people who are buying those are not thinking, well, how secure is this? They're thinking, wow, that's dirt cheap hardware. But I mean, probably what you're saying is the insecurity there isn't necessarily the hardware. It's the software underneath, and that's the point.
You know, it could be the hardware. It could be the software. It could be everything. Yeah. But you're right. For those devices, no one's buying them for security. So remember the Dyn botnet, right? Fall of 2016, those were default passwords in webcams like the one I'm speaking to you on now, in digital video recorders, right? Allowed hackers to hack those machines and create a massive botnet. And those devices were insecure. And if you think about it, I mean, let's say you have a DVR right now that has a default password and is part of a botnet. It certainly is possible that software is made public. There are hundreds of botnets that use it. You don't know if your DVR is part of that botnet. Hmm. And you kind of don't care. So from a consumer perspective, it doesn't really matter. And even if you wanted to buy a device based on security, it's hard. I tell a story in my book. While writing it, I helped a friend buy a baby monitor. He wanted to buy a baby monitor, and he was concerned about security. And we looked at half a dozen different baby monitors. We looked at their websites. We looked at the packaging. We tried to figure out which ones were more secure, and we couldn't tell. The data is just not there. Even if you are a security savvy customer, you're not able to buy things based on security. So the IoT is a security dumpster fire waiting to happen.
It really feels that way. And when you, Bruce Schneier, have a hard time, you know, figuring out whether these baby monitors have any sort of security practices in place, you know, everybody else has no chance. On the packaging, of course, there, if I remember correctly, they were mentioning, you know, that this is, they've employed secure measures to do this or that, but it's all very surface level, no intricate detail as far as what exactly is going on. No one stands a chance at actually understanding, and maybe you're right. Maybe they actually don't care when it comes down to it. They will when it has real world consequences for them, but if it's just that device ends up in a botnet affecting somebody else, people probably aren't going to care that much about that, right?
Right, and when it happens to you, again, it's hard to assign blame.
Oh, that's true,
right?
Yeah. So,
right? Let's say you're the victim of identity theft tomorrow. You're going to call up Marriott and say, I'm going to sue you. You're going to call up Equifax. You're going to call up any of the other dozens or hundreds of companies that lost your data. You can't string the harm back to the cause, right? Because there have been so many data breaches. And that actually has been a successful defense.
Yep.
You know, so again, right, the market is not solving the problem in the current state of the way the industry is regulated.
Yeah. You talk a little bit about patches being pretty ineffective. I mean, we've gotten so used to, at this point, the patch or the update being the solution to our problems. But I feel like we also realize that these things often come far too late. I'm an Android user. I know all about that on a personal level. Thankfully, I use Google's hardware, so I'm a little bit closer to those updates. But the majority of people don't, and they end up waiting for these updates that never happen and make them so incredibly insecure. I mean, what needs to happen there to make sure that this is an effective solution? Is it forced automatic updates, or is it just a total rethinking of how this is handled?
Well, so there's a lot there. You know, so updates are how we get security.
Yeah.
Right? Software is insecure. As I started with, you know, we're not willing to pay for quality software in the beginning. So if we're not going to do things right the first time, our only option is to be agile and fix things quickly when something goes wrong. And that's update. And if you think about the update successes, it is automatic updates, which happens to your Windows machine, your iPhone, happens to your Google phone also.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen to most Android phones because there's some handset manufacturer and telco in the middle, which is why Google decided to make their own phone to get that same closed ecosystem that Apple has. But patches are how we get security. Now, if you think about it, there's a security team at Apple, at Google, at Microsoft that are there to write and push out those patches as soon as a vulnerability is discovered. And that's why that ecosystem works. You start moving to IoT devices, and that ecosystem is not there. Most of those devices are designed offshore by third parties. They come together, write the software, then disperse. There are no security teams on staff to write a patch for your DVR or your webcam or your router. They're just not there. And sort of even worse, a lot of those devices have no way to patch them. And right now, almost certainly, the way you patch your home router is you throw it away and buy a new one.
Yeah.
Right? That's the mechanism. There isn't another one. So you can say you have to patch, but suddenly that changes the entire software ecosystem. And honestly, that throw it away and buy a new one is a good security measure. Every 3 to 5 years, we get new phones and laptops, and each one is more secure than the last. You move to consumer devices, they have a much longer lifespan. And that DVR you buy is going to last 7 to 10 years. That refrigerator, 25 years.
Right.
And I installed an IoT thermostat in my home last year, and I expect to replace it approximately never. So you're just not going to get that continuous improvement. I mean, what do we think? Think of a car, right? You buy a car today, software's 2 years old, you can drive it for 10 years, sell it. Somebody else buys it, drives it for 10 years, they sell it. This plane is probably put in a boat, shipped to somewhere in Latin America, where someone else buys it and drives another 10 to 20 years. All right. So go home, find a computer from 1976. Try to boot it up. Try to make it secure. Try to make it work. We have no idea how to maintain 40-year-old consumer software. We haven't the faintest clue. Microsoft, Apple, they'll depreciate their operating systems very quickly because it's too much work to maintain the old ones. We're going to have to figure out how to do that with appliances, with vehicles, with urban infrastructure, with a lot of things, and we don't know how. Right? Patching is going to fail in weird ways because we're not used to it in these new applications.
Obviously, the solution is artificial intelligence because that's the solution to everything nowadays, right?
Artificial intelligence and blockchain, I think, together.
Yes, both of those in tandem, and we've got the solution right there. We can stop the podcast now. You talk a little bit about surveillance capitalism. Obviously, surveillance is top of mind for a lot of people when it comes to privacy on the internet. Have consumers... Do you think they've been a little hoodwinked or maybe a lot hoodwinked as far as this is concerned to think that they are winning in this equation when the reality is they are not?
Hoodwinking consumers is part of the business model.
Yeah.
I mean, Facebook spends a lot of time trying to make sure you don't pay much attention to what your data is doing and where it's going as you share. Right? It's got privacy policies that are hard to read, hard to find. You know, that's part of the deal. Whether we're hoodwinked is another story. We're getting a lot of, you know, impressive stuff for free.
It's true.
And you know, that does have value. I think, you know, socially as a society, we have some decisions to make that these are probably not decisions we want to make as consumers and more decisions we want to make as citizens. Right? And that speaks less to deciding at the cash register or, you know, at the website, and more deciding at the policy level. But hoodwinked, you know, it might be too strong a term. I mean, definitely surveillance capitalism is the business model of the internet. It has some virtues. It has a lot of drawbacks. And it's about time we had a serious discussion about whether the costs are worth the benefits or there's any way to get the benefits while not paying the costs as much. But if the costs are American democracy, that feels like a lot.
Yeah.
If the costs are, you know, getting an ad for a car I don't want to buy, that seems okay.
Yeah, you talk a lot in this particular part of the book about kind of the political implications of security. It's obviously very top of mind. Much of politics and the power in politics and, you know, governments watching other countries and other governments feeds off of insecurity. It's almost like it requires insecurity to exist, as you write in your book. Is this different, would you say, from, say, 10 to 15 years ago, or are we just more capable of this now? Have things actually changed, or there's just so much more that these governments are capable of surveilling?
I think things have changed. I think changes of degree have made changes in kind, right? You know, in some ways, you can argue the surveillance that's being done is about the same as what the Stasi could do in East Germany. But the scale and the scope is so much greater and being done for such benign purposes that it changes the nature of what's happening. And we're seeing governments, you know, both democratic and totalitarian governments use surveillance data. Mm-hmm. Right? Use it for crime prevention, political control, right? The same data feeds that corporations use. So there really is this kind of alliance between companies and governments. Everyone wants our data.
Absolutely. And then you know, obviously, you know, as the title alludes to, click here to kill everyone. A large part of your thesis does kind of revolve around that, around this kind of movement from more esoteric things into the real world implications that we're seeing now. I have to ask myself or wonder how anyone, like, with an honest understanding of this,
how they didn't kind of see that coming or take any sort of action to prevent movement into that area. I guess it just monetarily it didn't make sense to it. It wasn't something that they had to address because they knew they could sell product and yet here we are. Is that right?
And remember, the company that takes security seriously, this product costs more, is later to market, mm-hmm. is less featured,
right,
and it is not going to survive. Right? The market doesn't reward security. The market rewards price and features and speed. I mean, that's what companies are going to do. And we're sort of seeing the same lessons being learned over again. Right? In the 90s, the PC industry learned about vulnerabilities and patching and how to make it work. And it just seems like those lessons were never passed to the auto industry, the medical device industry, let alone the internet-connected toy industry, mm-hmm. which are making these same mistakes. You know, we as a society are just not very good at being proactive. Actually, we as a species are not very good at it. You know, we tend to rush forward and try to fix it later. And, you know, that served us pretty well. The change will come when the dangers are so great that we can't afford to take that risk. And that time is probably coming pretty soon.
Yeah, you also have a part where you talk about supply chain vulnerability, and you know we had at least, I don't know if it was ever proven that it actually happened. There was the Bloomberg story about the little chip that was supposedly embedded in Macintosh laptops and a whole bunch of other computers and everything inserted in at some point in the supply chain. On a hardware perspective, I think you focus a lot more on the software side of things. How would users ever know? Like, that seems like such an incredible threat especially when you're talking about governments getting involved and trying to surveil or trying to find these vulnerabilities worldwide.
Yes, I mean, supply chain security is actually insurmountably hard. You mentioned the Bloomberg story. It's actually a little weirder than that. It was that chips were inserted into motherboards of servers destined for places like the Amazon cloud and the Apple cloud. Bloomberg reported this story. Supposedly the Chinese government did this. Apple denied it. Amazon denied it. DHS denied it. The UK cybersecurity center denied it. Everyone denied it. Bloomberg has not retracted its story. I wrote a blog post this week talking about that. My guess is it's not true. I think if there was such a chip, we would have seen a picture of it by now.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of a dumb way to put a backdoor into a server. If you're the government, like the U.S. or China, or you know someone big with a lot of resources, you're going to put a backdoor in the firmware. You're not going to put a chip on a board that people can see. You're going to hide it in something existing. That's the way you do a backdoor. So my guess is the story is fake, but the problem is very real. Right, you know, earlier this year, we heard a story about Huawei. Right? Should we trust Chinese routers or ZTE? Should we trust Chinese handsets?
Right.
Or remember Kaspersky? Should we trust Russian antivirus software? And there were huge debates around that. But honestly, that's just a very small piece of the problem. Where are the chips made? Right? Where are the devices assembled? Where are the programmers from? Your iPhone is from Apple, which is an American company, but it's not made in the U.S. Its components don't come from the U.S. Its programmers probably carry over 100 different passports. And so this is a robustly difficult problem. You can say, let's make a U.S.-only iPhone. It'll probably cost 10 times as much. No one will buy it. We really are very international in our supply chain. And any aspect of it can compromise it. And no one really wants to look at this problem because it's so hard.
Absolutely. So this is kind of the sad state of where we are. You spend a lot of, you know, the next third of your book talking about regulation, policy changes, focusing on action that can be taken and when that might be taken. We're going to talk about that in a second. First, let's thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation, and that is CuriosityStream. I am personally, I'm a huge fan of documentaries. I love documentary films. So often they're the kind of film that I seek out when I have like an hour and a half to kill. I don't know. I find them a little more enjoyable than say like a sitcom or something. So I love documentaries, and CuriosityStream is all about documentary content. It's the world's first streaming service addressing our lifelong quest to learn, to explore, and to understand. And you can really dive deep here. It's actually founded by John Hendricks, who is the founder of the Discovery Channel. And, you know, CuriosityStream, you're going to find it on all sorts of platforms, all the platforms that you're looking. So web app, Roku, Android TV, you can find it on the game systems, Xbox One, smart TVs, iOS, Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Amazon Kindle, Apple TV. Let's just say it's going to be really hard to not find CuriosityStream wherever you're streaming your content. And it's available worldwide, so it's made very available to you. And when you go on there, you're going to find a ton of content. It spans science, nature, history, technology, society, lifestyle, all different categories with award-winning documentaries, including Stephen Hawking's Favorite Places, The Hunt for Dark Matter, Birth of the Internet, Cyber War. They've got some really great animal content if you have a dog. The Secret Life of Dogs, sorry. And it's actually two different parts. It's a BBC series, The Secret Life of Dogs, and then part two. And each of those has a couple of episodes within them. If you like dogs like I do, you're gonna really enjoy that. Get unlimited access starting at just $2.99 a month. And you can actually check out their premium plan, which includes Ultra HD and 4K streaming for that new 4K TV you probably got for Black Friday. Or maybe I'm speaking for myself. Go to curiositystream.com/twit for limited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series. And for our listeners, if you enter promo code TWIT, when you are prompted during the sign-up process, and your membership is completely free for the first month when you do that. So enter the promo code TWIT, and you'll get the first month completely free. That's curiositystream.com/TWIT and code TWIT for the first month completely free. All right, so let's jump into some solutions. All right, so we've made this mammoth. We've created this thing that, I don't know, to me feels so large. It feels almost indefeatable, if that is a word. You in the book, you put it, you say it's man on the moon hard, not travel faster than light hard, which I think is a really great way to put it. So you're saying there's a chance. You say that you're hopeful.
I'm long-term optimistic, short-term okay. pessimistic. And right, I mean, we have tech challenges, but they're not unsolvable. And we can spend talking about the different tech that could be brought to bear against this problem. You know, the issue right now is public policy.
Yeah.
That it's not the tech, it's using the tech. It's getting companies to employ the tech. You go to security conferences, and they're full of companies with great ideas that nobody's buying because the market doesn't reward that. So I spend the really about two-thirds of the text. We keep dividing the book into thirds.
I know.
I think of the references as not part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think of halfway. The first third is the problem, the second two-thirds is the solution, and then there's the references after it. And it really, I'm talking about public policy. I mean, different ways to incent companies to make their stuff more secure. And it's a huge mess of different things. It's regulations, a lot of regulations. And, you know, regulation is something that is certainly a dirty word in the tech community. I think we have to get used to it because it was all fun and games when it didn't matter, and now it does. And the government regulates things that kill people. And regulations are certainly more than you must do this, you can't do that. There are some rigid standards, right? You can't drive more than 55 miles an hour is an example of one. There are more flexible standards, right? You can't drive faster than the road conditions allow. And most regulations in our society are flexible, right? Take due care when processing customer information, right? That could be a regulation. And what that means is interpreted depending on what the information is and how it's used. So I think we're going to need a lot more regulatory guidance on these devices and services and systems. I think there's an enormous place for liabilities, that when things go wrong, the victims need some right of action. And all that together, its basic goal is to raise the cost of insecurity. Right? Marriott lost 500 million customer records because it was cheaper to lose them than it was to secure them.
Right.
If they get fined, oh, I don't know, $10 per record, suddenly the security person's going to get a lot bigger budget because the risk of losing it is so much greater, right? So I want the market to work. But for the market to work, I need to incent customers to buy the stuff. And once I get that working, then the engines of innovation will just take over, right? Once Marriott says, oops, you know, we have a $10 billion potential liability here. We need to secure our systems. Companies will rush in to satisfy that need, right? And then innovation just takes over. But I need the incentive for that to work. And so in the book, I spend a lot of time on the details of that. And you know, I'm not very much an expert in this. You know, I just see it as an incentives problem. And I expect that the courts, U.S. government agencies, and eventually, you know, Congress will do something here. You know, not now. I mean, certainly, you know, the U.S. Congress is not able to pass laws like this. We're seeing stuff in the states. California just passed the first IoT security law, I think last month. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a start. It's not that great. It does say you can't have a default password, so that's good. But it is a start, and you have to start somewhere. California have passed a privacy law. New York and Massachusetts are doing things here. I think New York is going to sue Marriott for losing all of that that customer data. So the states are doing stuff. The EU, of course, right? The GDPR, massive privacy law. And the neat thing about this is that we're likely to benefit no matter where we live. I have no idea where you live. I don't live in California. Because software is very much write once, sell everywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, if a manufacturer, I'm going to make this up, a home thermostat, has to remove a default password to conform with California IoT law, they're not going to maintain two software builds, one for California and one for the rest of us. They're going to incorporate that improvement into software sold worldwide. So a law in a big enough market, California, the EU, other places, has the effect of improving security for everybody. So there's hope there, even if the U.S. federal government is pretty dysfunctional.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, the computer industry has sidestepped regulation for so long. This is kind of, you know, part of what we're seeing right now. In some ways, it's felt like kind of political theater. You know, Mark Zuckerberg or, you know, Twitter or Facebook, Google, they go to Congress and they testify in front of Congress, and then you don't really hear a whole lot about it after the fact. Seems like things are intensifying a little bit more around that. What are they resistant to in that regard? Because I have to imagine they would not want regulation to happen. What are the risks to them if the government does get involved to do this? Is it just higher cost because they're forced to spend the money on this security?
Sure. I mean, nobody likes regulation. It's perceived as costing more and giving them less flexibility, right? What you'll hear is it'll inhibit innovation. Right. I think that's absolute nonsense. I mean, you wander around industries and you just don't see regulation inhibiting innovation. Or if it does, it's a good idea, right? We regulate the medical industry because if they get it wrong, people die. So a little bit of innovation slowdown feels like a smart thing. And the internet was able to get away with no regulation for really two reasons. One, it kind of didn't matter. I mean, for so long, it just didn't matter. It didn't harm anybody. It was just data. And it was such a massive financial engine, wealth creation engine, that nobody wanted to touch it. And that's what's going to change as the internet moves into already highly regulated industries. Cars, planes, medical devices, right? Even appliances and consumer goods, those areas are traditionally regulated. And just because you put a computer in a refrigerator doesn't mean that it's like not a refrigerator anymore. And the car is still going to be subject to automobile regulations. And agencies are struggling to figure out how to regulate computers in these spheres. But, you know, as I argue in my book, we regulate technologies that kill. We do. And also, that regulation is going to be the only way to improve security. I mean, I don't think you can name an industry in the past 100 or so years that has improved security or safety without being forced to by the government. Cars, planes, pharmaceuticals, restaurants, food production, medical devices, appliances, consumer goods, workplace safety, most recently the safety of financial products. Right? Again and again, the market rewards having unsafe and insecure things and taking your chance. If we want a different outcome, we have to mandate it. And I think that spurs innovation. So even though companies hate it and will fight it, it actually is to their benefit.
Yeah, the long run, it kind of comes around. One challenge I feel like, and this kind of goes back to the baby monitor story that you mentioned a little bit earlier, is how companies can effectively illustrate how secure their products are for consumers. Because at its core, I imagine the majority of consumers aren't going to probably have a very solid understanding of the technicalities behind it. So, I mean, would that result in some sort of like an official labeling mechanism to say this is category 4 of security, or however they choose to do that to make it more palatable?
I mean, probably not. I mean, so I flew today. I know nothing about airline safety. I couldn't inspect an airplane.
True.
I don't know what to look for.
Yep.
And I didn't have to. I didn't have to look for a label that says, this is a C-grade airplane. Maybe you want a D-grade airplane. Right? If you work into a pharmacy, you don't have to worry that you better read the label carefully because the thing might kill you if you, right? You know, we expect the restaurants we go to, the food we buy, the planes we fly to be safe. Out of the box, without expertise from us. So I don't think we're going to have a consumer beware culture. I think for the baby monitor that some future friend of mine will buy, it will be secure. Otherwise, you can't sell it. And we won't have to try to decipher the labels and figure it out. And that's probably a safer world than a better world. You know, we don't want everybody to become an expert in everything. And we want to take our expertise, compartmentalize it, put it over there, you know, let them figure out airplane safety. All I need to know is, right, when does the plane take off and how long is my flight? I don't need to know anything about how the engines are built. Right? And I just think that makes for a better society.
If there are planes in the air, then I can assume that it's up there right and not wrong.
Hey, you know, but it is the safest way to travel.
Yes.
The taxi ride to the airport was the most dangerous part of my day.
Right. So then the flip side of this, of course, is that regulation can go wrong. Like that you spend a part of your book kind of talking about how policymaking can kind of go in the opposite direction, the kind of threats around those ways that I think people worry that regulation could lead to. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, and this is bigger than security. I mean, we know the problems with regulation. We know about regulatory capture. We know about bad regulation. You know, this isn't a problem that you solve once and go away and then do something else. This will have to be iteratively solved for the rest of our existence, like all the other of our regulatory issues. But, you know, there's really no better answer. And I think the missing part of internet security has been government. You know, we've let companies do what they want. We've sort of given programmers the right to code the world as they saw fit. And that was okay when it didn't matter. And now it does, and you kind of have to take away that right. Right? Society needs to code the world as it sees fit. That's harder. There are going to be challenges. There are going to be problems. But I know of no better solution.
So then you are optimistic on this. It's going to take a little time. A little might be the wrong word. It might take a lot of time.
Right. Like, I don't think we'll click here to kill everybody.
not in one click. Let's hope not, because that would be a really bad ending. But how long do you think it's going to take? Like, are we talking like 5, 10 years, 20 years? I mean, these are a lot of really complex issues, not to mention, like, just taking IoT as only one example, the sheer number of these devices suddenly entering people's homes in ways that they don't even consider them IoT devices, yet they actually are.
Like, I mean, I actually don't know. You know, I think right now it's going to take a long time. My U.S. government is not very good at regulating, but nothing motivates a government like fear.
Yeah.
After 2011, a small government Republican administration created a new federal agency out of piece parts with no real debate because they were scared. And the similar thing might happen if there is some large-scale disaster, say, you know, 1,000 cars have their brakes disabled at the same time or something like that. I mean, one of the reasons of writing my book is I wanted to have a debate about what regulation would look like before there was a crisis. So I don't know how to predict when. I think it's inevitable. I think Europe is going to lead, and I think we will follow. But it'll be nice to have some theory of what we should do before we rush to do something.
Absolutely. And you mentioned your smart thermostat. My last question to kind of close things out was to ask you if you have a smart home. So I imagine that means you do. I know earlier in your book, you also talk about taking systems offline. I mean, do those lines ever cross for you where you're thinking, you know what, maybe I don't need a smart home. Maybe it's just not worth it.
You know, everyone makes decisions based on costs and benefits. And I'm not going to fault anybody who makes the decision knowingly. And I have a internet thermostat because I travel a lot. And being able to turn the heat down when I'm gone and turn it up again 8 hours before I return is valuable. It saves energy. It helps the planet. It's a good thing to do. I mean, I don't have smart light bulbs and appliances and anything else because I don't see the need. But on the other hand, I play Pokemon Go on my phone, right? That's a surveillance-based game.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all make our choices. And, you know, we're doing the best we can.
Absolutely. Bruce Schneier, always great to get the chance to talk to you on the topic of security. Your book, Click Here to Kill Everybody, a fantastic read, very well researched, well thought out, and well written, as is usually the case. You're an awesome author. So I've just had a lot of fun talking to you about some pretty difficult topics. Bruce Schneier, thank you so much for joining us on Triangulation today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. We will talk to you very soon. Everybody, make sure and check out the book, Click Here to Kill Everybody. We do this show every Friday. You can catch us live at twit.tv/live at 3 p.m. Pacific. If you want to catch it live, you can do that. Otherwise, you can do what I would say most people do, and that's subscribe to the show. If you go to twit.tv/TRI for triangulation, there you will find all of the information that you need to find the show, to subscribe to it, of course. Leo also doing the show. Megan Maroney, we all get the chance to sit down with some amazing people and talk about technology, talk about their stories, their books, their background, and we've got a whole lot of really great interviews coming up, as well as amazing interviews in the past. So twit.tv/TRI to check out everything that we've done with Triangulation, and we hope that you'll subscribe. And I think that's about it. Thanks to Karsten, the producer of the show. Thanks to Alex for sitting over there and staring at me. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Really appreciate it, you guys. Bye, everyone.